Let's go ahead and get started. This is a meeting of the Title Setting Board in accordance with Article 40 of Title I, Colorado Revised Statutes. The date is March 5th, 2008. The time is 9 o'clock a.m. We're meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room, 1700 Broadway, Suite 270, Denver, Colorado. The title setting board today consists of the following. My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State, and I'm here on behalf of Secretary of State Mike Kaufman. To my right is Dan Domenico, Solicitor General, who is here on behalf of Attorney General John Southers. And to my left is Sharon Eubanks, Deputy Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services, who is the designee of the Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services, Charlie Pike. Ms. Eubanks will be sitting as the director's designee for the first agenda item, and then for the remaining two agenda items, the director's designee will be Dan Carton, who is also deputy director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services. To my far right is Ceci Gomez from the Secretary of State's office. There are sign-up sheets on the table by the door in the back for anybody who wishes to testify. When you testify, please identify yourself and who you represent, if anyone. The hearing is broadcast over the internet from the Secretary of State's website. All of the agenda items today are before us on motions for rehearing for measures that we have heard previously. And I'll go ahead and begin with the first agenda item, which is 2007-2008 number 61, Federal Standards for Discrimination, Preferential Treatment by Colorado Governments. the motion for rehearing was submitted by Richard Westfall on behalf of Jessica Peck Corey. So I think we should hear from Mr. Westfall first, I believe. If you'd like to come forward, identify yourself, and if you have any, we have the benefits of your written brief, which very much appreciate. And but if you'd like to highlight that, we'll give you a few minutes to do that as well.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hobbs, and thank you very much, members of the Title Setting Board. I don't want to go back over the ground of the brief. I think we cover that. I think what I'd like to do is I'd like to stress just how fundamental this violates the particular measure that's before you, violates single subject under the plain standards as articulated by the General Assembly in 106.5, and also then how fundamentally unfair and confusing the title is, if we get that far, again under the plain language that's set forth in the statute that is the direction from the General Assembly to this title setting board as to how you're to do your job in both determining whether something satisfies single subject and setting a fair and accurate title. Turning to 106.5, in 106.5E, I'll start with 2. E says the practices intended by the General Assembly to be inhibited by the single subject amendment to the Colorado Constitution are as follows. And I'll go to number 2 first, because that essentially tracks the organization that we did in our brief. This board is in making its determination on single subject, this board will look to determine, to prevent surreptitious measures and apprise the people of the subject of each measure by the title that is to prevent surprise and fraud from being practiced upon the voters. I respectfully submit to all of you that this is the quintessential surprise and fraud measure that comes four square within this prohibition that the General Assembly has laid out for you in making your determination on single subject. What is this designed to do? This is a measure that's specifically intended to swim in the wake of Amendment 31 and to say, guess what? If the voters vote for 31 and prohibit, and it's a state constitutional matter, discrimination and preferential treatment, then if they also approve 61, which is couched in exactly the same language in the first sentence, then we're going to go back and we're going to, what you're going to do is you're going to protect certain kinds of discrimination and certain kinds of preferential treatment. And it's designed to sort of swim in the wake. It's designed to very much elicit, to constitute that very surprise and fraud. I call the court's attention to, I think the one that really the case that maybe the most apposite is the 2001-2002 number 43 measure. Because there, that's where the proponents, which in the guise of, you know, petitions generally, and petition procedures, specifically would allow a single subject to be determined by this board, so long as you put it all in one section. And there was a colloquy that was discussed by the Colorado Supreme Court between Charlie Pike, Director Pike, and the proponents of that measure. And he said, "Is that what you're really trying to do? Is you're trying to say, so long as something is in this one measure, you can satisfy single subject?" And that's what the proponents agreed to. And then the Colorado Supreme Court goes on to say, "But there's other provisions in that measure that were specifically designed to exempt TABOR. So for all the folks, and some of you, I think all of, at least I know two of you were around at the time when." The folks that hated TABOR during the mid-1990s were trying to come up with a measure that would globally repeal TABOR. For those folks, you know, that tried and failed because it necessarily violated single subject under that whole line of cases during the 1990s. For those folks, they could say, "Aha! Here's our provision. This is the one that finally allows us to say, as long as we have the repeal section in an Article 10, Section 20.1." Then we're good to go. We can repeal TABOR." And they said, "Aha, not so fast. There's a trick here. Because we're, you know, buried in the folds was an exemption for TABOR. So that you could think that you were voting to repeal all, you know, a measure that would allow another measure to repeal TABOR globally. But guess what? TABOR was exempted." And that the Colorado Supreme Court found in number 43 to be violative of single subject because it practiced a fraud and surprise on the voters. The measure that we're talking about here does virtually the exact same thing, in the guise of saying, "Look, we're gonna have the same prohibition of discrimination and preferential treatment, and that's what this measure is all about. But what you're really going to be voting for is to preserve the very preferential treatment discrimination that 31 is specifically designed to forbid." So under 106.5E2, this particular measure clearly violates single subject because it purports on the people of the state of Colorado surprise and fraud, and for that reason should be stricken on single subject. Let's turn to E1. E1 talks about forbidding the treatment of incongruous subjects in the same measure, and thus securing the enactment of measures that could not be carried upon their merits. And that's something that this title board is also to prevent from happening. What does incongruous mean? As I'm preparing for this, I went back and actually looked up incongruous. I thought I knew what it meant, but it means, among other things, inconsistent. That's one of the principal definitions. I respectfully submit to you that a measure that's specifically intended, its very purpose is to preserve and protect preferential treatment and discrimination in certain contexts, that is inherently inconsistent, patently inconsistent, the first sentence of the measure, which specifically says it's, you know, that essentially tracks 31, prohibit discrimination and preferential treatment. And I would respectfully submit further that this measure was very cleverly calculated and designed the way it was to sort of, again, swim in the wake of a 31 and the overall general, if there's a overall voter sentiment for prohibiting preferential treatment and discrimination, that's what they want to hook their wagon to. That's what they want to make sure that they can be part of, so that when the voters say, "Oh yeah, this is a variation on the theme, this is just another kind of prohibiting discrimination, preferential treatment, I'll vote for that one too. I want to vote for that one, I'll vote for 31. Great. But that's getting, that's something that's securing the enactment of 61 that could not be carried on its own merits. I respectfully submit that if they want to go ahead and have a competing measure that says, "We want a measure that will specifically protect whatever government programs are out there that the United States Supreme Court would say are constitutional, that constitute preferential treatment and discrimination, that would otherwise be prohibited by 31, great. Articulate it, submit a measure, one subject, say that's the vote we want, and submit to the voters an up or down on that one. But don't hide it. Don't put it cleverly behind a measure that's designed to track 31, but then do something exactly the opposite. And so for that reason, both under just simple E1 and E2, we respectfully submit that this particular measure violates single subject and would request that the board reverse its decision and refuse to set a title on that basis. And I'd like to stop on that, and then we can maybe get on whether the title's fair and accurate.
Mr. Domenico.
Does your argument then depend on the relationship of this measure to 31? I mean, if there were no 31, would you think that this measure as written satisfies the single subject requirement, or is your argument dependent on the confusion created by the relationship of the two measures?
The latter. I think it's greatly exacerbated by the fact that it's being done in the specifically to, you know, a deal with 31 from the proponents of 61's perspective. But it's an exacerbation. Clearly the way this is a trick. 61's a design trick. It violates 106.5, you know, E1 and E2 on its face, irrespective of 31's existence. I just think 31 makes it grossly exacerbated.
And so your argument that does, to the extent your argument does depend on 31, I guess that answers part of my question, but to the extent that your argument does depend on how this relates to 31, I think you got into this a little bit, but you're not arguing, are you, that simply because 31 got here first, that then basically the people who disagree with 31 are kind of forbidden from submitting a measure that would counteract it or counteract part of it?
Or not at all.
Okay.
It's the fraud and surprise that aspect. It's the misleading aspect. It's the putting in two measures, you know, one sort of that mirrors 31, but then one that is directly opposite, which would violate E1, and then hook it, and then hitching its wagon to the same concept. That violates E1 irrespective of 31's existence.
I think that's all I have.
Okay. Ms. Eubanks.
Mr. Westfall, although you weren't explicit in your motion for rehearing, when I'm looking at the test that the Supreme Court has established in terms of the single subject requirement, mm-hmm. that it says that basically, you know, one subject and then not more, you can't have two or more purposes unrelated or unconnected. Mm-hmm. It seems like both of the arguments that you're making sort of relates more to the second prong of the test. Would you say it's fair to characterize your argument that both the first and the second sentences of the measure before us, number 61, relate to a single subject, that being, I don't know how you want to couch it, whether it's discrimination or preferential treatment on the basis of certain characteristics, that the two sentences relate to that general subject, but in terms of your arguments of relating to voter fraud being misleading, that those arguments go primarily to the second prong of the test?
I'm not sure I'd agree with Ms. Eubanks, and here's the reason why, because I really do think this is a situation very much analogous to, I think in answer to your question, I turn back to the, in the, was it 97, 98, 80, was number 84, it's the number 84 case, I think it was 97, 98, and that was the Douglas Bruce tax cut, you know, let's keep reducing local taxes, and then to the point where in actuality there's a separate purpose. I mean, it's all under the same context if you think, trying to analogize it to where I think your question's coming from, Ms. Eubanks. It's all under the context of tax policy, of reducing, you know, local tax revenue, but there was a necessary subsequent effect or separate purpose, if you will, that the Colorado Supreme Court looked to and struck it down on that basis because it was also going to end up cutting state programs because the state had to backfill that, and it was going to cause less revenue, so it was going to cause less revenue by the state, potential cutting programs by the state, All of that still comes within the general rubric, as I think, if I'm understanding your question correctly, with sort of tax policy and revenues generally at the state and local level. And so that's certainly a general subject. But getting back to this particular situation that we're dealing here with this particular measure, what we have is we have something that's designed to preserve preferences and discrimination, and the same measure is something that's designed to prohibit. And so the fact that it's under a general rubric of discrimination and preferential treatment doesn't protect two completely separate purposes, and I think the Colorado Supreme Court's clear on that. When one purpose is to preserve certain programs, and the first sentence is designed to ostensibly, and I stress that word, ostensibly, prohibit those very same discrimination and preferential treatment measures.
If I could, I do have a couple of questions relating to the case you cited, the number 43, dealing
okay.
with the sort of the elimination of the single subject requirement, but still preserving sort of single subject requirement for certain types of measures,
right,
Tabor,
exactly.
as well as anything else that the court may have mm-hmm. Found to previously constitute multiple subjects. And although this case was a completely different situation because you had a very lengthy measure that had a lot of different components to it,
mm-hmm.
in contrast to this measure, which is much simpler, at least in terms of length.
Complexity is not necessarily defined as Eubanks by the number of
words. And I understand that. But in terms of this measure, at least on its face, doesn't seem to have as many components as what was at issue in 43. But what I'm curious at is...
And I'm not sure even... you may be right on its face, but again, I'm not sure I'm going to buy your assumption, because I think when you get into the what does that deferring to the United States Supreme Court's interpretation of the United States Constitution mean in this context, that's very complex and it's very sophisticated, and it has, while that concept may be articulated in a very relatively few number of words in the measure, I would submit that it's equally as complex and equally as equally as broad and all encompassing, if you will, as analogous to what was at issue in 43.
And I don't disagree with you in that regard. I think the difference, especially when the court talks about voter fraud and surprise, they talk about it in the context of something being hidden because of the length or complexity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in 43, part of the issue there was the length as well as complexity.
And I could see that.
Whereas in 61, perhaps it's more complexity than based on length itself.
I would agree with that.
Okay. But going to the discussion in 43, specifically about the elimination of the single subject requirement and then the preservation of single subject requirement for certain types of measures,
mm-hmm.
I found it interesting that what was at issue there in a way is very similar to how one manner in which I characterized 61 at our last meeting in terms of a prohibition in a sense and an exception, that's sort of the way 43, that issue was placed. It basically was eliminating the single subject requirement, but making an exception to the elimination of that requirement in terms of preserving
mm-hmm.
that requirement in terms of certain measures.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be interested in the court talked about the effect of preserving the single subject requirement in 43
mm-hmm.
in the context, since the court had previously held certain types of measures, including Tabor, constituting multiple subjects, and that the language of 43 would preserve that. They talked about it in terms of constitutionalizing that precedent, that judicial, that although it wasn't changing anything in regard to the rule of law that the court had previously established through various decisions, that they viewed that was being constitutionalizing that judicial interpretation. Would you say that in 61, because of the nature of the second sentence, that it's dependent on the interpretation of the United States Supreme Court's of the U.S. Constitution, would you say that the second sentence perhaps has that same effect of constitutionalizing whatever has been judicially allowed in terms of equal opportunity, preferential treatment, similar types of programs?
I think if I understand your question correctly, the answer is yes, and here's why. Because it's constitutionalizing, it's putting in our state constitution essentially a delegation to, it's saying whatever constitutional limitation either we're doing in 61 or again tying back to 31 that prohibits discrimination and preferential treatment, then what we're doing is we're going to constitutionalize, we're going to reach out and say whatever the United States Supreme Court interprets with respect to the United States Constitution, that's now going to be a matter of state constitutional law. And that's really what it does. And I think it's, if I'm understanding your question correctly with regard to number 43, I think that's exactly analogous.
And then my last question is in regard to how you view that second sentence of 61. That if you have a program or service that's provided that does not meet the standards as established by the U.S. Supreme Court in interpreting the U.S. Constitution, that it's held to violate the Constitution, tell me what you think happens to that type of program or service if it's found to be invalid.
The United States Supreme Court interpreted a particular, arguably preferential treatment program and said that that was unconstitutional, then it would have been under, I think if I'm reading this measure correctly, then it said that would also be, quote, unconstitutional under our state constitution.
So, in your opinion,
I think it's sort of a distinction without a difference, because if it's unconstitutional in the United States Constitution, a fortiori, because of the Supremacy Clause, it's unconstitutional under our state constitution, so I think it's almost illusory, but...
And so would it be fair to say that, in your opinion, that you think that if a program or service doesn't meet the standards that are referred to in the second sentence of 61, then they don't exist?
It doesn't meet the standard that's set forth in the United States Constitution Equal Protection Clause or other similar measures, and as interpreted by the United States Constitution, it doesn't satisfy the second. And that's how comprehensive and global the second sentence is. It really does. It's a complete delegation to the United States Constitution and to the, as interpreted by the United States Supreme Court. It sort of makes a state constitutional amendment almost illusory.
Any other questions for Mr. Westfall? If not, thank you. I'd like to next hear from Melissa Hart on behalf of the proponents. And Ms. Hart, I'm sure you're prepared to respond to the arguments in the motion for rehearing. So.
Mr. Hobbs, I hope I'm prepared to respond to the arguments in the motion for rehearing. I guess I want to start by acknowledging, because I think it will be apparent, that I'm very nervous. And the reason I'm very nervous, there are two reasons. One is I haven't done a lot of these matters before. The other is because I was struck this morning thinking about this argument by the enormous power that this title-setting board has at this time. You have the power to end the effort of those proponents of Initiative 61 and the work that they've done effectively for this election cycle, and that's an enormous amount of power, and I think that that's why the Supreme Court, the General Assembly, and the people of the state of Colorado and the Supreme Court ask you to exercise that power with some respect for the initiative process that exists in our system, and with a liberal hand that will permit initiatives to be put to the voters, so that voters can consider the issues raised in them, except when they clearly violate provisions of the Constitution or the law. And again, that's supposed to be done with a deference to permitting initiatives on the ballot. Not surprisingly, I take issue with Mr. Westfall's characterization of the goals of the proponents of Initiative 61 and with the effects of the Initiative 61. framing it as he did in terms of 106.5 and the requirements of 106.5 first, I think we obviously don't disagree on what 106.5 says. Your job is to be sure that initiatives put forward do not constitute surprise or fraud, that they are not surreptitious measures, as Mr. Westfall said, and that there is not inconsistency or incongruity in the measures. All of that we agree with. That's clearly the law. We disagree pretty strongly on how the Supreme Court has interpreted these terms and on what Initiative 61 does in terms of those requirements. Mr. Westfall mentions the matter of proposed initiatives 43 and 45 as being most closely related to this dispute, and I think that it may be the most closely related, but it's a very distant parallel. That case dealt with an initiative that was, as Ms. Eubanks just said, four or five paragraphs long, extremely complicated in its wording, had sort of put itself under the global heading of protecting the political rights of citizens of Colorado as its subject, but then had provisions that dealt with the single subject issue, preserving the single subject issue for other things, how voting would occur. It was so complicated and so difficult to even understand what it was doing in its multifaceted series of subjects that it was really not in any way similar to the two-sentence Initiative 61 that quite clearly states its goals. And that's the same. The same is true with all of the cases cited by Mr. Westfall in his brief. The standard is only where the language is clearly misleading is this board supposed to not set a title. That's the cases from the Supreme Court say that repeatedly. In, for example, the matter of parental choice, in that case, although again there was this global parental choice as the idea, it was a very long, very complicated ballot initiative with several different approaches to the same general goal, and that actually was found to be a single subject because the same general goal of parental choice was what was at issue in that case. In the title for number 25, which Mr. Westfall referred to, the tax cut scheme at issue that had the $25 for each of these different tax bills over some number of years and reduction in programming, again, not found to be a single subject. It was a complicated, multi-part economic formula whose effect was very unclear and very different from the initiative at issue here. I just think the case law from the Colorado Supreme Court does not support the notion that there is not a single subject in this bill. The kinds of things that have been found to be fraudulent and surprising are nothing like Initiative 61. So if we were just going on the Colorado Supreme Court's case law, I think it's clear that there is no reason to reverse your decision of 2 weeks ago and eliminate the title. Moreover, even if there were no case law, even if all we were doing was looking at the language of 106.5 and talking about the need to prevent fraud and surprise, I simply agree that there is fraud or surprise in this initiative, and certainly at all, and certainly nothing that would constitute multiple subjects. What this initiative is designed to do is to present an approach to non-discrimination by the state. This initiative is designed to present voters with one way of looking at the problem that it happens Initiative 31 is also designed to do. And I think one of the things that was hard in Mr. Westfall's conversation and in the questions that were asked is it is hard to talk about Initiative 61 without talking about Initiative 31. It's important to because Initiative 61 stands on its own. It's its own separate measure. And its approach is simply a different one from Initiative 31's. But it is also, you know, it would be deceptive of me at this moment not to say that Initiative 61 came up in part as a response to the setting of a title for Initiative 31. And I want to talk about that because I want to say something about deception. I think it's important to get it on the record and to be clear about what the proponents of Initiative 61 are seeking to do with this initiative and are seeking to offer to Colorado voters. Initiative 31 came to this board last year You considered in both a hearing and a motion for rehearing whether to set a title for that initiative and ultimately decided to. I've read the materials from that process, obviously, and it really was because of that process that proponents of Initiative 61 decided it was important that some alternative be given to the voters of Colorado. Initiative 31 was found not to be deceptive by this board. I submit that Initiative 31 is deceptive. It's deceptively simple. It says the state shall not discriminate or grant preferential treatment to. And in the conversation, the colloquy that you had with Mr. Westfall in that process when he was representing the proponents of that initiative, there was a lot of discussion about what preferential treatment meant. And Mr. Westfall was extremely careful not to define preferential treatment. He was asked repeatedly by Ed Ramey, who was the lawyer for the opponents in that context, whether certain kinds of programs would constitute preferential treatment. He was asked whether posting a job notice in Spanish would constitute preferential treatment, whether women's health clinics would constitute preferential treatment, whether minority outreach would constitute preferential treatment. He refused to answer that the question with regard to any of those measures. He said preferential treatment is absolutely clear. The definition of preferential treatment is clear. We all know what preferential treatment means. And the decision was made by this board to set a title for that initiative on that understanding. I'm not here to obviously to relitigate that question. But what I will say is that Initiative 31 is identical to measures that have been passed in three other states in which that same approach was taken, the idea that preferential treatment is clear, we know what it is, everybody knows what it is. The consequences of the cookie-cutter Ward-Connerly Initiative 31 and what it's called in other states have been very different from what I think the voters of Colorado would understand preferential treatment to be. Among the consequences, initiatives designed to encourage the number of women to pursue fields where they have traditionally been underrepresented, such as math and science, no longer permitted in California. The California Summer Science and Technology Academy, which targets female and minority high school students who are underrepresented in those fields, no longer permitted. The American Indian Early Childhood Education Program, which is directed at school districts where more than 10% of students are American Indian. This is a elementary school program, no longer permitted. Student Opportunity and Access Program, which is a minority outreach and information network, no longer permitted. In Colorado, we have a number of programs that are like that, retention, training, outreach programs that many people would not think are preferential treatment, and that will be challenged and are likely to fall under Initiative 31 because of the failure to be clear about what preferential treatment means. That happened here, and it continues today in the signature collection process for Initiative 31, in which deceptive practices are rampant. They are being reported to the Secretary of State's office. People are being deceived by the proponents of Initiative 31 about the meaning of preferential treatment. They think they're voting for something that would eliminate one thing, race preferencing. In fact, they're voting for something that is going to eliminate a host of important programs that offer fairness and opportunity to the citizens of Colorado. Looking at that field, looking at what's happened in other states, looking at what stands to happen in Colorado and what we as citizens of Colorado stand to lose because of this initiative being brought into our state, proponents of Initiative 61 said we need to offer the voters something else. We need to offer the voters an opportunity to say we don't like preferential treatment, but we don't think preferential treatment includes the equal opportunity programs that the Supreme Court has said are constitutional. We don't think that in the state of Colorado, the summer camp that CU offers to women and minorities and other underrepresented populations considering engineering should be eliminated. We don't think that outreach programs that target minority schools to ensure that they have full sense of the information of what you need to do to get ready for college, of what you need to do to prepare yourself to succeed in the world, should be eliminated. We don't accept that definition of preferential treatment. And for that reason, we will come up with an initiative, a different alternative approach to the same problem, which is the problem of discrimination by the state and how to provide equal opportunity and fairness from the state to its citizens. One subject, a single subject. We are not being deceptive. We are offering an alternative that seeks to address deception that we feel is going on, not we feel, that clearly is going on with Initiative 31. We want the voters of Colorado to have that opportunity to vote for something that represents more what we believe in, that represents more of a support for programs like outreach, retention, recruitment, equal opportunity programs, but that will not eliminate those problems in those programs in the way that they've been eliminated in other states. We don't want this cookie cutter initiative to come in and destroy a lot of what Colorado has done. So yes, this is a response to Initiative 31. On the other hand, to say that you have to think about Initiative 31 only as in the context of Initiative 31, Initiative 61 in the context of Initiative 31, is simply incorrect. Initiative 61 is internally coherent. It's internally consistent. The only way it's inconsistent is if you accept the definition of the proponents of 31 of preferential treatment, which is a broadly global definition that eliminates everything. That is not what 61 is trying to do. We are saying we constitutionally want to say in our state's constitution, no preferential treatment, but yes to the limited programs that have been found constitutional by the United States Supreme Court and that do not constitute preferential treatment. They constitute equal opportunity programs, and we do not want them destroyed in this state.
Questions?
I feel strongly about this.
Thank you. Are there questions for Ms. Hart?
I have a question. If I could, Ms. Hart, I'd like to ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Westfall in terms of sort of what I perceive perhaps as a similarity between 61 and what was presented in 43, at least in regard to the single subject requirement being eliminated but yet preserved for certain measures that previously had been held to constitute multiple subjects. And whether or not you think it's a fair characterization of the second sentence of 61 that it could be viewed as constitutionalizing the U.S. Supreme Court's interpretation under the U.S. Constitution in regard to these types of programs?
I quickly tried to look through the case on 43. Sure. My recollection is that the part where the court talked about constitutionalizing was when it discussed the issue of putting at the state constitutional level matters that have traditionally been local. That is the property rights and zoning. Is that correct, or is it?
No, it was specific on, and I don't know if you have the case in front
of
you.
I do. Yes, I do.
Let's see. Of course, mine's printed out on LexisNexis, so we'll see if I can get the page right.
Westlaw, incompatible printer formats.
That's right.
So one of the things I would say, I guess, just about the difference between 43 and what we're dealing with here is that 43 was an initiative that was designed to fundamentally change the process for voting on initiatives, and so. Partly that makes it puts it well outside of most people's experience, and I think makes it inherently more confusing. People don't as a teacher of civil procedure, I can say that people don't have intuitions about procedural things, and so when you put in front of them procedural measures, the potential for confusion is sadly much higher than when you put in front of them substantive measures. And I think this issue of constitutionalizing procedural modifications. Is more what the court was concerned about in that regard in this case. Again, my memory had been with the property thing. But
I'd refer to you to footnote 11, which I believe appears on page 47.
Not surreptitious because it does not. I see. Okay. Again, I think the issue here is that constitutionalizing these procedural rules is a significant change from what the state law was at that time. To the extent that, and I think I understand so I don't think it's the same as what's going on here. I do think that, again, what Initiative 31 seeks to do is to enact, as a matter of state constitutional law, a lower bar across the board on preferential treatment, equal opportunity, et cetera, than is set by the federal Supreme Court. And what Initiative 61 seeks to do is to say no preferential treatment, but we accept the Supreme Court's bar with regard to equal opportunity programs. We think that the kinds of modest equal opportunity programs the Supreme Court has allowed, and it's a very limited set of programs, is fine under our state constitution. And I don't think that's a delegation of authority, as Mr. Westfall said, to the federal constitution or the federal Supreme Court at all, the U.S. Supreme Court at all. In fact, it's a statement of affirmation by the Colorado voters that we accept that limited approach, again, defining preferential treatment not to eliminate those limited programs. It is constitutionalizing something. Obviously, it would be a constitutional amendment, but I don't think it's... I think the parallel with 43 is not quite there because, again, just as Mr. Westfall's or Mr. Connerly's initiative would constitutionalize a particular approach to non-discrimination, ours would also constitutionalize a particular approach to non-discrimination. That's what a constitutional amendment is supposed to do.
But it would constitutionalize it based on judicial interpretation.
Of the U.S. Constitution. Just to be really clear, the reason that the proponents for Initiative 61 put it that way was we wanted to be clear that this was that what we were endorsing was that modest interpretation of U.S. constitutional law, the very limited amount of equal opportunity programming that the U.S. Supreme Court's interpretation permits, that it says is not illegal preferential treatment. So we were seeking to constitutionalize that limited set of programs, yes.
Okay, and then in terms of your response and getting into what the U.S. Supreme Court has allowed in terms of equal opportunity type programs and services, that takes me to the other question that I asked Mr. Westfall, and that's in regard to if a particular program and service or service that is based on race, based on national origin, one of those bases, and it's found not to meet the standards of the U.S. Constitution by the U.S. Supreme Court, is that program permissible?
No. Not under this initiative. This initiative says...
Is
it currently permissible?
Yeah. Would such a program that doesn't currently meet the standards, whatever they may be, as established by the U.S. Supreme Court, be permissible?
No.
No.
And so let me say something about that, because one of the criticisms that has come out, at least in the newspaper, of both the proponents of Initiative 61 and me myself, is that somehow the deceit that we're seeking to engage in, and I'm tired of being called deceitful, but the deceit that we're seeking to engage in is... something about not first, you know, saying we're going to eliminate preferential treatment, but then saying we're going to keep it, and then also not admitting that somehow this is all about the status quo. What I would say about that is that it is often the case that laws will be passed that that largely parallel the status quo. A constitutional amendment in our state constitution does a number of other things, though. First, it is an affirmative statement of commitment. Second, it creates a constitutional standard that has the benefit of making a firm and committed statement by the people of Colorado about where we stand on this, which means that we don't debate this anymore, right? We're not going to come back and argue again about whether we're going to eliminate equal opportunity programs. We've made a commitment to it. And third, and I think this is really important and is again related to the deceit that's being practiced by the proponents of number 31. Third, it makes an affirmative statement of commitment to end a confusion that a lot of people have. And that is, people in this state and people all over the country misunderstand what is allowed and misunderstand what happens. People continue to believe, contrary to all information, that quota systems are in place in universities. That someone asked me recently, "Oh, well, so would this end the thing where African-American applicants can have a way lower SAT score than white applicants. There's a lower cutoff for them. CU doesn't do that. People don't do that. But there is this misunderstanding out there which is being manipulated to encourage voting for Initiative 631 that needs to be clarified, that needs to be affirmed by the voters of Colorado. We do not accept that, even if it's not happening now. Or to the extent that it is happening, and again, I don't think it is happening, but to the extent that it is, we want to make clear that it is not okay. It is not okay under the federal constitution. It is not okay under the state constitution. And the proponents of 61, it's not, again, this comes back to, I think, Mr. Westfall's incorrect arguments about our goals. Our goal is not all encompassed in the second sentence of Initiative 61. We have two goals with regard to non-discrimination here. They are consistent and congruent goals, but there are two goals. And one is expressed in the first sentence of Initiative 61, which is to say preferential treatment's not okay. Discrimination is not okay. And the second is to say, this is not, when we are talking about preferential treatment, we will define what they will not define. When we are talking about preferential treatment, what we mean does not encompass these programs.
Question, which actually relates to the language of your measure. And I'm just curious, in terms of the language that you used in the first sentence of subsection 1, where you make reference to race, sex, color, national origin, those types of descriptors. You don't have those types of descriptors in your second sentence, and although you relate it to the public employment, public education, and public contracting. And so I'm just curious, and this is basically because I'm no expert on the U.S. Constitution or this particular area of law, as to whether or not the second sentence is relating to the standards that may exist. Do those relate only to those descriptors in the first sentence, or are we talking about other types of standards?
For purposes of this amendment, this initiative is only referring to those descriptors. So we only intend to be referring to the standards set under the U.S. Supreme Court with regard to those descriptors. So, for example, you'll notice that age is not included in the first sentence. This initiative doesn't address discrimination on the basis of age and the standards that exist with regard to age discrimination. It's just not encompassed in this initiative. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Domenico, questions?
I don't think so. I think Ms. Hart and I had our discussion last time.
Well, I'd like to ask some questions, and I'm still struggling with this, and my questions may be somewhat repetitious, and I'm sorry. I'm really struggling to understand the measure. I do agree with something you said, I think, at the very beginning, that I think the board, needs to be careful about blocking the door, basically, and that's why last time I voted in favor of setting a title for the measure, although I expressed concerns about it, but I wanted to err on the side of petitioner's rights, basically. But I'm still really struggling with this, and part of it is although we've talked about this a lot, and I may be the only one who's still having trouble understanding the measure, I really don't think I understand it. And I do know that the Supreme Court has said that the board has a duty to understand the measure.
Right.
And I see that the measure prohibits preferential treatment programs, and then in the first sentence, and then in the second sentence, I think I understand that the second sentence permits some preferential treatment programs, but I'm really not clear on the difference.
So I think here's what I want to be accorded the same permission that Mr. Westfall was accorded with Initiative 31, not to say here's a Colorado program I think is this or that. I am the attorney representing the proponents of Initiative 61 at this initial stage. I have not sat down and said, here's a list of programs I think pass muster. Here's a list of programs I don't. And I don't want to have to do that. And again, Mr. Westfall didn't do that with Initiative 60. It's Initiative 31. What I will say is I think that the kinds of things that I mentioned that were that have been found that have been found to fall under what was Prop 209 in California, and what I think would fall under Initiative, or I fear would fall under Initiative 31 in Colorado if it passes, are things like recruiting programs designed to encourage the number of women pursuing math and science studies. I don't think recruiting programs are preferential treatment. So you're saying your understanding of our initiative is that it eliminates preferential treatment but then allows some preferential treatment. And I think that's part of what's hard about the definition in Initiative 31 as well, is that there is dispute about what preferential treatment is, and that's a huge political question, definitely.
If you don't mind, I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, that's
but
fine.
You know, I do want to be fair about it, but it seems like with number 31, we didn't have to figure out what preferential treatment programs meant because it simply prohibited them. Here, what I'm struggling with is it prohibits them and then it allows them. And so it calls into question, does the second sentence take away everything in the first sentence or nothing from the first sentence?
And again, I guess I don't think it prohibits them and then allows them. I think it prohibits discrimination and preferential treatment and then provides the second sentence to define certain things as not preferential treatment. And those are the programs that have passed muster on the U.S. Supreme Court. So I didn't bring, unfortunately, the court's cases with me. But, for example, in Parents Involved, the Supreme Court's case from last term, Justice Kennedy talks about programs like recruiting and training, building schools in certain neighborhoods, in order to encourage participation by minority communities. There's an understanding that the state has an obligation to its minority citizens who are being underserved, but not through quotas or race preferencing, instead through other measures, again, recruiting and training and outreach, education. Those are the kinds of programs that can be very effectively used to reach underserved populations, but that are not race preferencing. They are not preferential treatment. And in the way that we have defined preferential treatment in Initiative 61, that is what we are trying to do, is to provide a definition that will not see those programs fall in the way that they will under Initiative 31, that will not see minority outreach programs fall, but that will say, yes, we do not think quotas are okay. We are constitutionalizing in the state constitution an affirmation that quotas, race preferencing, that preferential treatment is not okay, but we are ensuring that preferential treatment is not defined so broadly that the kinds of programs that no one out there actually thinks are preferential treatment, when they vote for Initiative 31, they don't think they're voting. Some people do, but lots of people don't think they're voting for what they turn out to be voting for. And we're trying to provide an alternative to say, you can vote for something different. You can vote to eliminate preferential treatment, but still to preserve the programs we know you want to preserve. And those programs, again, we define, the initiative defines them as not being preferential treatment. It's not an inconsistency, it's a definition.
But if they're not preferential treatment, then they're not prohibited by the first sentence.
And this is where it's hard to talk about 61 without talking about 31. Experience teaches us that in other states where Initiative 31's equivalent has passed, those programs are falling. And it is because we want an alternative to that wholesale wasting of the fairness and equal opportunity measures that other states had passed and are now losing that the proponents felt Initiative 61 is important.
Well, one possibility that I think I might be hearing you say is that the measure would prohibit preferential treatment programs in the form of quotas, but allow preferential treatment programs in the form of targeted recruitment.
Again, I'm resistant to the notion that targeted recruitment is preferential treatment, but yes, I think that's correct.
Okay. And I think, in trying to understand what the measure does, that's helpful. I'm also trying to weigh in my mind the discussion that you've had with Ms. Eubanks, that even if it doesn't actually change anything, perhaps it's constitutionalizing something. And I think you were agreeing with that. I mean, constitutionalizing the status quo.
Yeah.
Currently in, well, as currently interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court or as may be interpreted in the future.
Yes.
Okay. Let me shift gears just a little bit. One of the things that if we find that the measure has a single subject, then we're required to clearly express that single subject in the title. And I don't think our title does that. It says concerning a prohibition against discrimination in the state. That's the title that we set. That's the expression of the single subject.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem like that is a fair or accurate expression of the single subject based on the discussion that I think I'm hearing. I mean, what I think the measure is about is preferential treatment programs, first of all. And I'm not sure how to express the single subject, but are you happy with that expression of single subject, or would you suggest another one?
I think that it does concern a prohibition against discrimination by the state. Again, this is the single subject of Initiative 31 and the single subject of Initiative 61, as you decided it last 2 weeks ago, start in the same way, an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning a prohibition against discrimination by the state. And I actually think, as I started by saying, that pretty accurately reflects what's going on here. These are two different approaches to a prohibition against discrimination by the state. The voters will have to decide which they prefer, and it will be the job of the proponents of the two initiatives to educate the voters about the two approaches. But in fact, they both are addressing discrimination by the state. I think that is a fair statement of what Initiative 61 is seeking to do. It is to address prohibition against discrimination by the state. And connected to that, just again to be clear about the second sentence, what the second sentence is seeking to make clear, is seeking to do, is to say these things aren't discrimination. The proponents of 61 look at recruiting and training and outreach programs as not being discrimination. That's not the kinds of preferential treatment that constitute discriminatory preferential treatment are outlawed by Initiative 61. That's clear in the first sentence. And then in the second sentence, it's made clear that that does not include this broad reach to these other programs that are being struck down in other states. We don't want that imported here. We want a different model of equality.
Well, I'm still just having trouble seeing this measure as being about a prohibition against discrimination. And with respect to number 31, I could. Now, to me, the discussion there that we struggled with, and it was a struggle, was that there were different points of view about what discrimination is, what the term means, and there was a point of view that discrimination means discrimination against, as opposed to discrimination in favor. And from the proponent's point of view, I think discrimination included discrimination in favor. But clearly, to me, the measure was about discrimination. Here, I'm not so sure that that's the case directly, that it's quite so clear that it's just about prohibiting discrimination depending on how you define it. I think one thing that is fairly persuasive to me in the brief for the motion for rehearing at the bottom of page 3, partially quoting a Supreme Court decision, Mr. Westfall says, a voter of average intelligence would be surprised to find out that a ballot initiative that purported to prohibit discrimination and preferential treatment was, and I'll skip some of the hyperbole perhaps, but was it instead allowing the state to engage in discrimination and preferential treatment to the full extent allowed under the United States Constitution? And that seems like that's a fair statement of the measure. But
I guess I think that there is, even taken craftily out, there is rhetoric there. There's an assumption that what the U.S. Constitution, that what the U.S. Supreme Court permits is discrimination. That's an area of disagreement between us, and I think it's an area of disagreement that is used to cause voters to believe that what they're voting for is an anti-quota bill, when in fact that's not at all what they're voting for with Initiative 31. So again, part of the goal in Initiative 61 is to provide an alternative that forces a fair and open discussion about what the differences are. They're both against quotas. We're all against quotas. So we're all against the discriminatory preferential treatment. This is a different issue. But let me say, I don't want to really fight with you about the title, because the most important thing, obviously, to the proponents of Initiative 61 is that they not be shut down when they have here an initiative that clearly has a single subject. That subject is how to deal with equal treatment of citizens by the state and what the best approach to that is. This is a single subject. We want the opportunity to collect signatures, to have this on the ballot, to present this alternative to the people of the state of Colorado. And if I thwarted that by bickering about the language of the title, then I would have disserved my clients. So the most important thing to the proponents of Initiative 61, obviously, is to have the chance to present this alternative to the people of the state, not what the specific wording of the title is. At the same time, I do think the title, as currently set, is accurate. But again, do what you will, just don't kick us out.
Let me ask, I think maybe just one more question. It kind of goes to the discussion about whether the measure is misleading or not. Although maybe we could approach this by expressing a different single subject, we're still dealing with a measure that starts out by saying discrimination is prohibited, and that seems to lend itself to the argument that it's not really about prohibiting discrimination. It's really about, as I said, it's more about continuing to allow certain forms of preferential treatment programs allowed by the Supreme Court, depending on what they are. That's more what it's about. But I guess my question is, why not? And normally I don't ask about why the proponents draft the measures the way they do. But here, it seems like there is a more direct path in that the drafting could have taken. And I don't know the exact words, and maybe that's why it's not done that way. But if the idea is to constitutionalize preferential treatment programs that are permitted by the U.S. Supreme Court, it could have been drafted that way. And by starting out as an anti-discrimination measure, that's what makes it seem like it's a little misleading.
Right. And again, I think I can't agree with what you're saying, because I disagree with your characterization of the programs allowed by the Supreme Court as being preferential treatment programs. And I think that what this is an expression, an affirmation of a particular vision of discrimination, non-discrimination, and the goal of non-discrimination that clearly prohibits discriminatory preferential treatment, but preserves what I don't think are preferential treatment programs permitted by the Supreme Court. So we're talking across each other because we see them differently. And so I'm not trying to be obstreperous. I'm trying to think about I guess I'm now going back to 2 weeks ago and thinking about the staff draft of the title, which said a program. And I, Ms. Eubanks and I had a discussion about whether it should say concerning the preservation of equal opportunity or the concerning a prohibition against the denial of equal opportunity. That may have been a better characterization of the goals of the proponent. I think Mr. Domenico pointed out that equal opportunity was then a debatable phrase. And I think, again, one of the things that's very hard in this area, and this was true with 31 and it's true with 61, I acknowledge the difficulty of this, is that language in this area of discussing discrimination and preferential treatment and equal opportunity and all of these kinds of programs, language is so fraught. And coming up with the best way to characterize these things that fully explores what the proponents are trying to do is hard, and the proponents of Initiative 61 really struggled in coming up with the best way to draft their language, with what would be the best way to meet their their total goal with regard to non-discrimination, their total goal with regard to non-discrimination was both to make a strong statement against preferential treatment and to be clear that the definition of preferential treatment didn't include what was already there. So it was not a question of, you know, oh, let's just get rid of the first sentence. The first sentence does something important, and the second sentence, too, does something important. They are both very important to the vision of the proponents of Initiative 61 and the vision that they would like to offer as an alternative to the people of Colorado.
Okay. I do have to ask a question now about that. What does the first sentence do, then? If there's something very important about it, what types of things is the state doing that the first sentence is intended to change? That's what we're supposed to be able to understand.
Right. I am not going to get into specific programs and say this is a thing the state is doing, that is in fact doing, that it can no longer do. What I will say is it seems very clear to me that there are lots of things that people in Colorado believe the state is doing that they don't want the state to do. So many people believe that quota hiring is happening or that quota admissions to education, to educational opportunities are happening. It was in order to address that belief, not because we think that that's happening all over the state, but because people do seem to think it's happening all over the state. And we understand and we agree that there should be a clear statement by the people of Colorado that we don't want. I don't want quota hiring. I don't want quota admissions. It is not acceptable under our Constitution to do that. So I don't need to say, here's the thing that's happening that will change. I can say, here's the thing that people don't want to have happening, and we don't either, and we want to make it clear that it's not allowed. And I think it's important to do that because I think it's important to clear up a huge misunderstanding that's out there, to allow people to say, if this is happening, to the extent it's happening anywhere, and again, I don't actually think it is, but people think it is, to the extent this is happening anywhere, no. This is not okay. But again, we are not defining this to eliminate the kinds of things that are being eliminated in other states, the kinds of outreach and recruiting and training programs that have been successful in providing equal opportunity in Colorado.
Well, then the question I have about that is a lot of your argument about what 31 would do and how you think it's deceptive really to me suggests that if you're right about that, you'll have a very strong argument when 31 is challenged and in front of the Supreme Court that it should be interpreted in the way you argue it should, that it shouldn't apply to these. Because, of course, the court is supposed to interpret measures in a way that it thinks the average voter intended it to be interpreted. And so if you're right about that, if you're right about what people generally interpret these phrases to mean, then you don't really have anything to worry about.
Right, well,
as long as you can convince a court of that, right?
Right.
Or the Supreme Court.
And I think I have two things to say about that. First, I'll return the favor and say that Mr. Westfall has quite craftily refused to respond to questions about what preferential treatment includes. And so the legislative history on Amendment 31 gives nothing for argument. That was nicely done. But there's nothing there for argument to the Supreme Court or to any court about what it means. A. B, the chilling effect of an understanding of what's happened in other jurisdictions and what's likely to be challenged in Colorado under a program that eliminates preferential treatment but doesn't define it and then appears to be being interpreted very broadly in other jurisdictions will be significant in terms of its impact on programs in Colorado and whether there's still funding available for them or support for them. So totally independent of what's directly prohibited, the impact will be huge. And that is all, I think you quite rightly say, that is all part of what I'm sure will be, this is sort of not my bailiwick, but I'm sure there are going to be people out there who are doing a, you know, no on 31 campaign or whatever the yard signs will read. That's one thing I'm sure will happen. The proponents of 61 wanted to do something different from that and are entitled to do something different from that, which is to offer a different alternative to the citizens of Colorado, not just no on 31, but let's make a statement about what we believe non-discrimination in the state of Colorado means. Let's make a statement about what we will tolerate and what we will accept and what we stand for in the state of Colorado. And that's a different thing from a no on 31 campaign. And that's, I think that's what the proponents of 61 are trying to do. So you may disagree with their approach, with that you may think, well, just do a no on 31 campaign. But they wanted the opportunity to participate in the initiative process that our state permits to offer this alternative to the citizens of Colorado.
Well, and I certainly think they're entitled to do that, and I think the debate you suggest the people of Colorado should have would be terrific. I really do think that a debate on what preferential treatment on the basis of race and sex and these things is, and what should be allowed and what shouldn't, would be valuable. But this measure doesn't do that, is the problem I have. I mean, and you may be right that 31 doesn't do it either, but I'm not sure that two wrongs make a right is the sort of thing to base our decision on. I mean, the problem I have here is that this makes one blanket statement using terms that I certainly agree are debatable about their definition. But the second sentence, there's no doubt to me that the second sentence makes the first sentence essentially irrelevant, because the state already can do what whatever is allowed under the standards set by the U.S. Constitution. And I don't have a problem with, as you say, constitutionalizing the status quo, especially when there's a threat to the status quo from this other measure. And so I don't have a problem with your attempt to do that. But when you essentially, in the first sentence, say, we are making a change to the status quo, and then the second sentence completely eviscerates the first sentence, which I don't think there is much doubt. At least it eviscerates it in many, many important ways that would appear important to the average reader. And obviously, you know, we're in a tough spot. You and I probably disagree about what the average person interpreting these terms understands, and I don't know that there's a way for us to come to an agreement on that. I mean, that's just one of the difficulties of the role we're put in here. But it seems to me that I do wish that the proponents had taken another angle at this, because I think this simply, and I don't, not because you or the proponents are intentionally set out to deceive people. My understanding of this doesn't turn at all on your subjective motivations. I just think that the average voter would be at best confused by this and at worst misled. So that's not really a question, obviously, but you feel free to respond.
Again, I mean, as you've said, you and I just disagree about this, and I obviously feel strongly about it, so saying I feel strongly is sort of irrelevant, but this is a two-sentence initiative that presents to the citizens a prohibition on discrimination, and I appreciate your saying that you don't mind our constitutionalizing the status quo. I guess when I think about this, I think, you know, if we didn't have a due process clause, and then people said, you know, we should have a due process clause, not because there is actually a rampant problem with violation of due process, but because it's worth expressing that we stand for due process. I think that would be something that would be a good thing to do. And particularly good to the extent that there are people in the world who believe that there is not due process. And so I think this is the same kind of thing. I don't think that, as I've said before, I don't think that there is quota hiring going on, or that there's quota admissions at CU's educational system or CSU or any of the educational systems. I don't think that the K-12 programs in Denver, and again, one of the things that to keep in mind is that this is all education. I don't think that the K-12 programs in Colorado are engaged in quota hiring, but some people do. And I think it's important for us to be able to say we don't want that. But I think it's to say that the definition provided in the second sentence, the definition of preferential treatment, is inconsistent with preferential treatment is because you have accepted a definition of preferential treatment. It's because you think preferential treatment means a particular thing. This is an interpretive question. It's a question for debate and dialogue and education by the proponents of the initiative to the people. But it's not multiple subjects. It's a single subject. And that single subject is discrimination and preferential treatment, how we define it, and our desire to prohibit it. I would hope that the alternative you would consider if you feel that you have to change what I think is a perfectly clear, again, short and clear title that you set 2 weeks ago, I hope that what you would consider is rewording it in some way and not simply eliminating these proponents' right to get on the ballot and to have this discussion with the citizens of the state.
Any further questions for Ms. Hart? Thank you. I do have one other person signed up to testify, Lou Ellingson. Did you want to test? Okay. Come forward and identify yourself, if you will, please.
My name is Roberto Carrada. I rise in support of Proposition 61, or Initiative 61. I just really want to preserve one argument for appeal, and that is the argument wasn't made. Proposition 31, I do think it's unfortunate that a lot of this discussion has been one viewed against the other, because I do think that those in favor of Initiative 61 should be able to come in and argue 61 on its own merits. And I think a lot of the argumentation really, even though it's tried not to center on 31, exists because 31's in the picture. And I think that's unfortunate. In terms of the language here, I think, Mr. Hobbs, that if it said an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning a blanket prohibition against discrimination, you might rightfully have a concern. But it doesn't say that. Initiative 31 also has a number of exceptions to the general statement that there shall be no preferential treatment. One huge one is allowing federal programs that allow preferential treatment to continue to exist. Now, under the Constitution and supremacy, those would be allowed to exist anyway. But the truth is, when this type of proposition came up in various state legislatures without that exception, people voted against it because they feared that not having the prohibition would cause those federal programs to go away. So that was put in for very strategic reasons. That exception is an exception that people could drive a truck through. It includes not only Title VII, but arguably programs under Title VI, which could include a variety, I mean, almost all preferential treatment programs that you could think of. Huge exception. I was here for the hearing on 31. I don't recall a lot of questioning about the exceptions and the nature of exceptions to 31. Another huge exception to 31 that was made in oral argument by Ed Ramey at the time was that 31 has an exception for bona fide qualifications. People don't understand bona fide occupational qualification. I teach the subject, and it's hard enough for very sophisticated law students to understand it. But the BFOQ allows express discrimination, express preferential treatment. What a BFOQ does, if you prove a BFOQ, is that you can have an ad in the paper that says men only need apply for this job. The 31 creates not just a BFOQ, but a bona fide qualification that applies to public contracting as well as education. That sort of preferential treatment exists in no law. It's a preferential treatment category that's expressed, that's created by 31 and no other law. 61 doesn't create it. So arguably, there's a preferential treatment that's created that doesn't exist by 31, even though it starts out saying there shall be no preferential treatment. There are a number of other exceptions in 31. I don't think you're saying that initiatives have to be absolute and that they have to be blanket. You can have exceptions. The only difference between 61 and 31 is where we draw the line on exceptions. We allow more types of programs that 31 arguably does not allow. And I say arguably because in the 31 hearing, a lot of time was spent asking
the proponents of 31 to identify what preferential treatment was, and they refused to answer it. I even testified then, and I said, does it mean you can't put a postage stamp on a recruitment letter aimed at somebody you know is black or a woman? They refused even to allow that. This is why 61 was crafted, because we thought 31 was deceptive in that preferential treatment is understood by people to mean certain things. It can mean a number of things. It's not a self-defining term. We wanted to put forward a debate on the issue of what preferential treatment is. Now, Mr. Domenico, you might like that debate to take place, but the truth is the best way for the for that debate to take place, and it's already happening, is for an alternative initiative to be on the ballot that makes somebody say, geez, what's this doing that this one is not doing? And already there have been editorials in the paper that are distinguishing the two, and they're causing that debate to happen. Those kinds of debates did not happen in California or Washington State or Michigan. They're happening here, and we think that's the best thing for Colorado because it means that people will be more educated about the choices they have to make on the ballot in November.
Questions? Okay, thank you. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? And I'll give you a chance, Mr. Westfall, in just a moment. I don't see anybody else who wishes to testify. So, Mr. Westfall, for final arguments.
Mr. Hobbs, if I could just have 3 minutes to go out, because Ms. Corey, movement, would also like to speak. I think there's over an hour's worth of colloquy. There's a number of things that I could spend time disagreeing on. I don't want to burden the board with a full 30-minute point-by-point rebuttal of many of the things we heard, and I think if you will just afford me about 3 minutes, I can go out in the hallway and I can try to be structured and very focused on final closing comments if you would allow me.
Okay. That's fine. We'll take a 3-minute recess.
Thank you very much.